You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Tennessee just sounds perfect, whether that's live music, the crack of a campfire, or kids laughing on an adventure. To start planning your trip, visit tnvacation.com. That's tnvacation.com. Tennessee sounds perfect.
From Shakespeare to Schwartz, from Fosse to Alvin Ailey, from Sondheim to Bareilles, from McNally to Fay, it happened to the greats, it still happens every day. When lightning strikes, it's the moment you know. You can stand and shout Eureka, do whatever you like. You'll never forget the moment when lightning strikes.
Hi, this is Gerald Brunner, and you're listening to When Lightning Strikes, where we talk about the tingly mic drop moments that led you to becoming an artist. Stephen Boyer currently stars in the dazzling hit musical Kimberly Akimbo, now playing at the Booth Theater. He also received a Tony nomination for the show Hand to God. Some of his other credits include Time in the Conways, I'm Not Rappaport, Assassins, Moscow, 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 We Crashed, Love Life, Borderlands, Hustlers, Chicago Fire, Trial and Error, and he plays lead guitar for the band, the US Open. Welcome!
Thanks. That was a lot of Moscows you just
That's
said.
A lot of Moscows. But did I get the Moscows right?
I think you got the Moscows.
Yeah, I love that show too. You had the most prolific career so far. And I was saying that here I saw you in Hand to God play a teenager, and Right. Now you're Buddy the dad in
That's
Kimberly
right.
Akimbo.
Yeah, it's very funny because, you know, that was at the Booth seven years ago. And so the last time I was at the Booth, I was a teenager, and now I'm back at the Booth playing an alcoholic dad. I'm like, that was a hard 7 years.
look what happens in what 7 years. Oh my God. Well, that's such a testament to you and your acting chops to go in 7 years to make that leap. Can you talk about when Kimberly Akimbo came into your life? Because you originated this role, right, at the Atlantic Theater, and as Buddy, the dad, the alcoholic dad, who I'm convinced has a lot of love and a lot of, that's what I adore about this
he
play.
He does have a lot of love. Thank you.
And he cares about his family.
That's right.
In ways that are very complicated and often dangerous, but he does care about his family. But when this project came upon your inbox, came by your agent, what went through your mind? Can you take me to that moment?
First of all, I don't get auditions for a lot of musicals. I tend to just do new plays. And so I was excited that it was a musical, first of all, because I used to do musicals all the time, and then it just kind of stopped. So I was excited for that, but then I saw that it was David Lindsay Baer and Janine Tesori. And I was like, I don't need to read anything else. This is going to be incredible and groundbreaking and amazing, and it's going to be hilarious and heartbreaking. So I'm in. I've known David for like 20 years, over 20 years, because he was a playwriting fellow at Juilliard when I was a student there. And I've known, I've seen Janine's shows for the past 20, 25 years as well, and have always been a fan of hers. And so I knew that this was going to be a special one just based on that team. I was cast in February of 2020, just before the world shut down. And So I kept getting emails like every 6 months. They were like, you still interested? We're still going to do this. Are you still around? And I was like, yes, I'm definitely still interested. And so we took almost a 2-year break between when I was cast and when we started up at the Atlantic. Yeah. But yeah, they held on to it. They knew they had something special, so they didn't want to let this one go.
It's such a beautiful, beautiful life-affirming musical, which started as a play, you know, which I love too, you know, years ago. And can you, for people who might not know what the show is about, if somebody were to ask you, what is Kimberly Akimbo about? What would you say?
So Kimberly Akimbo is about Kim, who is a 16-year-old New Jersey teen in the late 90s. And she's dealing with all the stuff that a teenager normally deals with. Except she also has this dysfunctional family. Her father's an alcoholic. Her mother's a narcissist. Her aunt is a career criminal. But the biggest factor that she is dealing with is that she has a rare genetic disorder where she ages 4 to 5 times as fast as she should. So her life expectancy is only 16 years, and she is about to have her 16th birthday. But the show is hilarious.
It is hilarious, and the music is spectacular.
Right, yes.
Every song really brings you in. And totally. And I think about the songs you sing and how they, you know, develop your character. They develop Buddy even further and further and further. And mm-hmm. I love the song also. Is it called Inevitable Turn, where you're all sitting at the dinner table? And it, you're in their minds. And that's, again, the genius of, well, of all of you, and then Janine and David and your orchestrator, and how the songs really inform the show in such a unique way that you don't often see.
Yeah. That song is great, Inevitable Turn. It's it really is three family members inner monologue all at once, and how everyone is waiting for the explosion that they know is going to come. It's also the only time that I get to sing with Bonnie Milligan in the whole show. So it's a treat.
That must be a joy. Yeah. And what was the joy of bringing the show to Broadway? Because I loved it at the Atlantic. I love the intimacy, and I still feel that intimacy at the booth. I still feel that deep connection that you had, even though it's a bigger space.
Right.
Yeah.
I think the booth was the theater that we were hoping to land at for the Broadway run, because it would preserve that intimacy. You know, I'm used to the process of developing a straight play off Broadway. You know, and this is my first time doing a new musical, and there is a lot of stuff that I had not anticipated. The way that it's not just about spending 8 hours a day on the acting choices. It's like, we're going to spend a little time on that, and then we're going to trust that the performers are going to figure it out. And then you have to focus on so many other factors. Things like the way that interstitial music cues like affect the automation of the set and the automation of the lights and how this staging has to be a certain way because we need to make room for some hydraulics or something. It's these things that I had never had to think about in any production, because I've never done a Broadway musical. And there is a level of production that, even with our, you know, seemingly small, scrappy show, there's a level of production that I hadn't had to think about. And so the process was kind of different for me. I was unaccustomed to it.
And what qualities do you love about Buddy? I mean, I know he's so damaged, and he makes all these mistakes, but there is love, and he's very human. And I know, as I said, he's talked about before, he deeply cares.
yes,
for his family. And I see him as, I feel like he wants to save his family in some way, and yet just it gets fumbled and bumbled along the way. But
you know, it's like even if as a parent you absolutely love your family and your children, it doesn't mean that you're good at being a parent to them. I mean, like, Buddy means well, but he is incapable of parenting in the way that he needs to. He became a parent when he was a teenager.
Yes.
And so he's emotionally stunted. He's frozen at that moment in his life. And he was not ready for the responsibilities of parenthood, and he's still not ready, and he's still denying those responsibilities, even though he does love Kim, his daughter, very, very much, and cares about her very deeply. He doesn't know how to show that or how to act upon it.
Yeah.
So he makes mistakes. And also his inability to deal with his life circumstances, you know, lead him to drink uncontrollably. And it's been really great to work on, because I love characters that have they aren't just one thing.
Yeah.
You know, Buddy is very funny in the show,
but
but he can also be cruel.
Yes. In a second, he can turn.
Yeah.
And what's extraordinary, I love that song, See the World, where you're talking about your dreams and how you gave up your dreams. You didn't explore your dreams. You wouldn't let yourself really explore your dreams because you became a father so early.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, it's so hilarious. You know, I love seeing you being so caring for Kimberly too, you know, and how I get how it's you're laughing, like hysterically laughing at all the things happening, and then it's so sad, you know,
mm-hmm.
the pieces and how that changes in the matter of seconds. You know, and it's so convincing. What's extraordinary too is that I totally believe that you're Kimberly's dad, even though she looks, you know, decades, somewhat older than you.
Right.
But that, you know, there is, you're still a dad.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of that is on Victoria Clark. I mean, she does such a convincing job playing a 16-year-old girl that you just forget that it's Victoria Clark up there. I mean, she inhabits a teenage girl so fully that it makes my job being her dad kind of easy. But the hard thing about it is caring. The hard thing about it is caring so much for someone that you know is not going to be around forever. And having that heartbreak every night, and you know, two shows on Wednesdays and Saturdays. It's a lot of heartbreak. That's the hard part about the role to me. This is the first time I've played a father, and I also became a father a few years ago. And
congratulations.
Thank you. And so since then, you know, I really feel like I understand what it feels like. The feeling of that you are disappointing your kids, or that you are somehow, like, you know, you have this job that has the most responsibility in the world. You are shaping, you know, a young person, and you're trying to make them the best and the healthiest and the most fully realized that they can be. And your ego gets in the way, or your temper gets in the way, or you just don't know what to do. And the feeling of I'm not doing this as well as I should is a real palpable feeling that I have as a parent. And it's awful. It's a terrifying feeling. And to be able to But to be able to sort of exercise that in a piece of art is very fulfilling.
That's a beautiful thing. Yeah, and I think of all the layers of every character and what an ensemble. And I love that you all originated your roles at the Atlantic, mm-hmm. and then you all moved right together
right. Yeah.
to the booth and just solidified and keep exploring.
For sure.
I want to talk about your lightning strikes moment when you knew you had to be an artist. Was there, or moments when you thought, this is the life for me?
I've had a few different ones for different reasons. I mean, I feel like I always kind of, I was a child actor in Columbus, Ohio. I did a lot of children's theater from a very young age and was doing, you know, two shows at a time, you know, from the age of like 10 until I left at 18. And I felt like this is what I was supposed to do from a very young age, because, you know, even before I got on stage, I always felt like a performer, like not necessarily an actor or an artist, but a performer, like someone whose job it is to make people laugh. Like that was just my job. That was my job in the family. My job was to impersonate people and tell jokes and sing songs and crack people up. And so I took it upon myself at home and at school to be that person. And then my parents kind of, you know, funneled me into community theater and was like, let's let this kid work out some of his excess energy in a productive way. And it really, really took. But some of the actual like lightning strike moments that I can remember, I worked on a play called The Lohman Family Picnic by David Margulies when I was 16. I played the bar mitzvah boy, Stewie. And it was again, this kind of combo of hilarity and sadness, you know, the dramedy that I have tended to do pretty much for my whole career since. And I was 16, and the people playing my parents were the, you know, two different acting professors from Ohio State and from Otterbein College. And it was at the One Equity Theater in Columbus. We had One Equity Theater, Contemporary American Theater Company, which is called CATCO. And I remember I had this confrontation scene with my father where he tries to take my bar mitzvah money. And it was like the audience was holding their breath every night, and we would have it would escalate into this physical fight between, you know, tiny 16-year-old me and this like hulking man who played my father. And it was electric every time. And I was like, it felt so great to kind of know that I could manipulate an audience in a way, because they were laughing and laughing and laughing the whole show. And then that scene comes along and out of nowhere, they're devastated. And I was like, yes, I did that. I made that happen. And it felt incredible to be able to take people on a journey and pull the rug out from under them and make them feel something. And so that was really when I was like, this is it. I can't do anything else. This is it. I have to keep going. And then I feel like, and you know, once the career got rolling, there were other lightning strike moments, like other revelations, not necessarily about this is, you know, the life that I am meant to lead, but just different ways to sort of navigate that life and that career. I I had been unemployed for, I mean, the better part of a decade after I got out of Juilliard. I'd done one Broadway show, I'm Not Rappaport.
Yeah.
I thought that everything was going to be smooth sailing. And I ended up maxing out, you know, credit cards for the next decade, paying my rent and buying groceries, because it just, the next job was not right around the corner. And I started I got tired of doing theater on the road. I got tired of doing regional stuff. I wanted to stay in New York City because I felt like no one actually knew who I was, because I was trying to go out of town to take jobs when I could. And I ended up hanging out at the Ensemble Studio Theater, where, you know, it's a developmental theater. You're not going to get rich working there, but it's where playwrights and directors and actors go to create new work. And it almost felt like going to the gym. You know, it's like exercising my muscles, getting to work on new characters, getting to originate characters, getting to collaborate with playwrights to flesh out story points, you know, and beats, and have true collaborations with a director and a writer, where you are crafting the character with them. That was a moment that working at EST really changed my entire life.
And not to give away the punchline or the plot, you know,
there are many punchlines.
You want to say, wasn't there a play being developed there called Hand to God?
Yes, Hand to God was, we first did a, you know, a reading at EST. It started from their Young Blood playwriting program. That's where Rob Askins was when he wrote the first draft, and we did the first reading, and we did so many readings and so many workshops before finally EST was like, we have to do this. And they kind of shoehorned it into a season that was already planned, because the artistic director, Billy Carden, was like, he saw a reading of it and he was like, I've never seen he's like, the people were screaming in that reading. He's like, they were screaming with laughter. And then at the end, they were just screaming because they were terrified. And he's like, we have to do this play. And so that crazy, crazy play got a home, and Broadway producers noticed it, which is unbelievable. Like, that play had no business going to Broadway. People were like, what is it? Why do you have a satanic puppet on Broadway? But it just had an effect on audiences that was undeniable. I owe that to Ensemble Studio Theater.
And P.S., not only did it go to Broadway, but you got a Tony nomination.
Yes,
for your riveting performance as this teenager who's and also playing the puppet,
right? Tyrone.
Tyrone.
Yeah. Yes.
The demonic.
It's funny because people come up to me now at the stage door and they're like, who knew you could sing? I had no idea. And the thing is that, you know, a lot of them mentioned that they had seen Hand to God before. And the thing is that the puppet in Hand to God sings through the show. Like, he sings You've Lost That Loving Feeling. He sings some Smokey Robinson song. He is singing nonstop. And which is like, you know, gags and stuff and jokes and stuff that we developed in the room that weren't necessarily there in the first draft. But it's funny because in their mind, it's like, well, that was Tyrone. I knew Tyrone could sing. I didn't know you could sing. The puppet. Yeah, no. Yeah, he sang a lot.
Well, that's a credit to you, because you don't, it seems like Tyrone is like a living, like existing independent from you, even though, you know, you are Tyrone.
Yes, that was the magic trick.
There was a magic trick. And you were so different. You know, this kid is so different from Tyrone, mm-hmm. and that you inhabit the, and then, you know, he inhabits you, and it's fascinating and terrifying and, again, hilarious.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
And I just want to go back, though, to you said when you were a kid and you had to entertain your family. Do you remember what that came from? Why that was inside of you?
I had way too much energy. Oh. I was incredibly... I was constantly, you know, pinballing between things, and I couldn't stop. I really couldn't stop making jokes. Like I loved Robin Williams from a young age, and I sort of like, I was like, that's like me, because I couldn't stop making jokes. And I look now and it's like, it's the same. My father does the same thing. And I realized that it's really just genetic. But, you know, and in a different world, you know, he should have maybe been a performer instead of a psychologist. But from a very young age, I would impersonate people. I would do I would do voices and impressions. And it was usually people, you know, characters from TV, or it was people we knew. And people in the family, and I realized early on that was like, that bit worked. that got people cracking up. So
I loved
that for a while.
I was sent your SNL, your Saturday Night Live audition tape, and it's brilliant.
Oh,
all the characters.
Thanks. We had to pare that down because there were like twice as many impressions on that, and we had to pare it down to like 10 or something.
Michael J. Fox and the combo of him and
Michael J. Fox was an early one. That's been with me for a long time.
But then Gandalf and oh gosh, it goes on and on, and then the original characters, and it's just delicious. Yeah, and what kept you going during that dry period? You know,
that is a good question.
Because I think God, I'll hear you. You graduate from Juilliard, you get a Broadway show with, you know, I'm Not Rappaport, these big stars, and then...
You think everything, it's all going to be smooth sailing, but
how did you keep...
No.
Yeah.
You know what? I was losing my mind. I needed to be in front of people. I mean, that kind of sounds weird, but I needed... Oh. I really, like... was a performer in search of an audience. And the thing is, as an actor, you're waiting for someone to give you that opportunity. You know, it's you, unless you create work for yourself, which is really the solution for a lot of people. You're at the whims of, you know, theaters and seasons and directors and casting and what have you. So I started writing stand-up material, and I started going to clubs, and I started doing comedy for a while. I got passed at Stand Up New York on the Upper West Side and got to do late night shows there on the bill and met a lot of different comedians. And one of them was like, you want to come with me on tour and be my opening act and my feature act when I headline? And I was like, yes, please let me do this. So I got in a car with someone I hardly knew for 4 months, and we drove across the country and we did like 7 gigs a week at colleges and comedy clubs and you know, sleeping in crappy hotels, and it was great.
Does that experience help inform your choices as an actor, or what you bring to a role? It, you know, that comic timing?
It absolutely does in certain ways that are very tangible and then in some other ways that are less so. Like before I did stand up, I had a really hard time in a play with direct address. I did not like talking directly to the audience. I didn't know what to do. I couldn't, you know, it was just very hard for me. And stand up is all direct address. So I had to get over it. Now I'm fine talking directly to an audience. I also learned, you know, how to write a joke and how to write material for yourself, which has come in handy for any number of things. I mean, I had to host the Drama League Awards 1 year, and, you know, I wrote 20 minutes of jokes roasting everybody.
With Tyrone, wasn't it?
Yeah, with Tyrone, which is why it was okay. Because the puppet can make fun of Helen Mirren, and it's fine. Yeah.
Tyrone,
if I did it, he'd be like, who are you? And get off.
But Tyrone can get away with insulting.
You can get away with anything.
Tyrone the insulting.
So, but then other things, like, you know, it's always, you always try to listen to the audience. You know, you try and make sure that you keep, you know, one ear kind of tuned to what their reaction is. And especially in a comedy, because you want to know what's working. You know, sometimes this audience likes the physical gags. Sometimes they're more into the cerebral jokes. Sometimes they like wordplay. And you can kind of hear that in the first few scenes of a comedy and then kind of tune your dials to give them the best performance possible, or just to sort of get them involved. And because once an audience starts rolling, the whole show becomes better for them and for you on stage.
It's like you're always taking the temperature.
You're always taking the temperature, always. Yeah.
And I love also that you went to, did you go to Juilliard right out of high school?
Yeah.
You auditioned and
were
one of the very few who got in,
yeah.
Which is phenomenal. And what was that experience like for you?
I was coming from Ohio to New York. Somehow seemed very natural to me. And I came to New York, and I was like, "This is where I should be. This is the place I always imagined living, and this is the kind of life I always wanted." I loved coming to New York. And so there wasn't a culture shock in that way. But then, you know, I was 18 years old. I missed out on a college experience. And in my mind, a college experience involved, you know, partying and skipping class and having like these, you know, romanticized college experiences like you'd seen in like an 80s movie or something. Like I was expecting Animal House or something, but it was an arts conservatory where they are expecting you to perform at a level of at a professional level, and I was 18, and so I for the first couple of years I really rebelled against the authority of my professors at Juilliard. I just was like, I'm here to show you that I know how to do it all. And it was, I really thought that I knew everything in a way that maybe if I had gone at an older age, I would have had some more humility. But that was back in the day when Juilliard still had the, like, we break you down to build you up kind of mentality. It was very old school. We still had some people that had been there from year one. So they broke me down. I mean, they broke me down. And then it wasn't until third and fourth year when we get to really perform in front of an audience that I felt like I kind of came back to what I knew I could do, or like what I thought my strengths were, which was really playing to an audience.
But you stuck with it.
I stuck with it.
To be so, yeah. And you're really part of this ensemble doing, you know, shows and repertoire. I mean, endless plays and the classics and everything. Yeah. My goodness.
I took the opportunity, you know, we got to pick scenes. I really took the opportunity to do things, to play characters and bring in scenes for characters that I would never play.
Like what, like who?
Like I was like Stanley Kowalski, or like I was, you know, Macbeth, you know, and I was like, I was a 18-year-old kid who was like short and skinny and looked about 12. But I'm like, if I can figure out how to make choices, character choices that justify why I would be playing this character, then that's a success. And so that was sort of the goal that I laid out for myself in school. I was like, this is how I'm going to use this to its maximum effect. I'm going to try and inhabit the characters that are the farthest from me.
That's so great. What a challenge.
Yeah, that's how I laid it out for myself.
Do you feel like you take things you learn, that they stay with you even to this day, you know, pieces of your training?
Little things. Yeah. You know, it's easy to kind of like look at the whole thing and be like, what happened? It was kind of a blur, you know, for 4 years. But there are phrases and moments and things that kind of stick out. The first year acting teacher, John Styx, was an old studio theater guy. You know, he had like James Dean and Marilyn Monroe in his acting class at back in the day in the 50s, and his stuff stuck with me the most. I mean, one of the things that he would say that kind of is always there, no matter what I'm working on now, is it's like, don't do what's probable, do what's possible. And, you know, because it's easy to be, when you're trying to figure out the scene, like, well, they want this, so they're going to go after it like this, because that makes sense. That's logically, if you wanted to achieve your goals, this is the tactic you would use. And that may be true, but there are other possibilities that might be more interesting and unexpected that can get you the same thing. And so exploring not what's probable, but what is possible is always helpful, no matter what you're working on.
I love that. That makes you stretch.
Yeah.
And to go back for a moment to Kimberly Akimbo, I heard that you wear some of your father's...
Well, they're not literally his clothes, but yeah, they are really close. I mean, Sarah Lux, the costume designer, I got into the room to try and stuff with her, and I was like, did you raid my dad's closet? Because this is like his uniform from like the late 80s into the 90s. I mean, I wear the tan windbreaker, the dad jacket that, yes, you know, he wore for decades. I'm wearing the white Reeboks that he mowed the lawn in. I got the like acid wash jeans that he wore out. And you know, I even have like the little gold Casio digital watch that beeps every hour, you know, and like has a little blue light up background. And these are like little, you know, photographs in my mind of my dad from when I was a kid. And it helps. It really helps.
What is it like for you when they come see the show, when your family comes?
It's hard. It's hard. My dad got sick recently. He came to, my parents came to see it at the Atlantic, and then about a week after that, he had an accident and became ill, and he is still dealing, you know, with this illness. And so it's tough. It's tough. And they're the audience that you kind of want to impress the most, especially when you're playing a parent.
Yes.
And you're dressed like one of your parents, it adds just this kind of surreal element to everything. And also, you know, so I'm on stage playing a father dressed like my father who is ill. And the play is all about the time that you have left with the ones you love. And so there's a lot going on in the background of this play for me every night.
I'm so sorry.
That's okay.
You're dealing with that. What a gift.
I mean, you know, it's
you in it.
Things come along at the right time.
Yes. What a beautiful time.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that the show is healing for many people.
Absolutely.
As well.
Yeah, I think so.
Yes. And I love that you're in a band. What does that give you?
It's a band. It's a bunch of actors that started a rock band. And we all say whenever we have, you know, practice or something, we're like, this is the most fun thing that I get to do. It really is. It's like, you know, actors want to be rock stars.
Yes.
They just do. And rock stars want to be comedians, and comedians want to be actors. It's like the circle of life. And but it's just this, you know, it's this other part of your brain. Yeah. I mean, I play a lot of instruments and I love learning new instruments, you know, based on the information. You're like, can I translate learning piano into playing accordion or guitar or saxophone, or, you know, like how can one instrument sort of be a gateway to any number of other instruments? And so when I started playing with other people, it was like, oh no, this is really where it's at. It's like not playing by yourself, but music created with other people is so much more fulfilling. And it also has elements of developing a new play. It's funny because everyone in this band is an actor, and we met each other through working on new works. And we take the same approach to making music that we do from creating a new theater piece. So it's very, very collaborative, very fulfilling, super fun. And we have an album that's on all the streaming services, and you can buy it if you want. It's called We Are the US Open. It's a great rock album that will make you dance. It's a lot of fun.
Do you write songs together?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we write songs together.
It's so great. Oh, Stephen. Well, it's such a joy to have you on the show. Thanks so much for coming on.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome, and congratulations.
Thank you.
It still happens every day when lightning strikes. It's the moment, you know.
The theme song was written by Tom McGovern. This episode was edited by Kyle Moore. This episode was produced by Anna Strand. When lightning strikes.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org. Because only together we rise.
With everything you have on your plate, earning your degree online seems impossible. But at Grand Canyon University, we specialize in helping you fit a master's degree in education into your busy day. Your graduation team, led by your own GCU counselor, provides you with the personal support you need to succeed. Achieve your goals with a plan and team behind you. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Visit gcu.edu.